Not our usual introduction music for today's open air. When you have a full Baroque ensemble on hand live, you want to take advantage of that. You're hearing Agave Baroque in the background. They'll be performing with countertenor Reginald Mobley this weekend for concerts under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society, titled Peace in Our Time, Music of Love and Loss in the Shadow of the 30 Years' War. Also stopping by this hour, composer Jake Heggie, who is part of the commemoration of Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday in a joint double bill production by Opera Parallel and SF Jazz of Bernstein's chamber opera, Trouble in Tahiti, and Heggie's one act at the Statue of Venus. Both works explore personal relationships and the struggles in one's quest toward happiness. Writer-director Maury Bobrow shares details about his original musical review, Megabytes, the Musical, a show of comedy and songs and sketches in this tech age that we're in. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, discusses Steven Spielberg's new movie, The Post, with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, and its relevance in the current political climate. Plus, thoughts on the 2018 Oscars. All ahead here on Open Air. Well, as 2018 closes the 100th year anniversary of World War I, it begins the anniversary of a much older yet no less important conflict involving Western civilization. The year 2018 is the 400th anniversary of the beginning of the 30 Years' War, a war that still stands as one of the longest and most destructive in European history, that surrounded the unrest between Protestant and Catholic regions in the Holy Roman Empire. A death toll of some 8 million people and a nearly 40% decrease in the overall population in German states. Staggering numbers indeed, even in the shadow of the two great wars of the 20th century. Yet, just as with World War I and II, in the shadow of the violence of the war, beauty can bloom. Music and art served as a balm, a B-A-L-M balm, for much of the populace, not least in helping the people of that time sort through their grief. And that's what serves as the inspiration for Agave Baroque's performances this weekend under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society, Peace in Our Time, Music of Love and Loss in the Shadow of the 30 Years' War, this weekend, with performances on Friday at First Presbyterian Church in Palo Alto, at 7:30 on Saturday at St. John's Presbyterian in Berkeley, and Sunday afternoon at 4 at the Church of the Advent here in San Francisco. SFEMS.org for more information on that. And that's the music from Agave Baroque that we've been hearing in the background. They'll be performing live here in the studio over these next few minutes in this segment of Open Air. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David LaTulipe, your host for our afternoon foray into all things performing arts here in the Bay Area coming up. So Agave Baroque is an ensemble consisting of Aaron Westman, Natalie Carducci on violin, William Skeen, cello and viola da gamba, Kevin Cooper, guitar and theorbo, which you heard, we'll have more on that fascinating instrument shortly, Henry Lebedinsky on harpsichord and organ, and guest countertenor Reginald Mobley. Aaron Westman is going to talk with me now about some of the goings-on of this concert and what the inspiration was for it. Aaron, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Sure, I'll take the Carnegie Hall out of your voice there. Added a little echo for you guys. Fascinating topic and such beautiful music. Thank you all for coming. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I think.
Yeah, we have two other members that weren't on your list. We have Anna Washburn, who's playing viola and violin.
Anna, welcome back.
And Katie Keim, also playing viola.
Great. Well, let's hear some more live music, and then perhaps we can talk about the inspiration for this, and Reggie can share some of his music as well. What are we going to hear next? What are we going to hear next, Aaron? What would you like to play?
Okay, so this is a lamento written by a Bach family member, Johann Christoph Bach, one generation before the famous Johann Sebastian. This is probably his most well-known piece, and it's the text is from the Lamentations of Jeremiah, and it's just a really striking piece. It's not very long, so we thought we would share it with you, and it features our countertenor soloist, Reginald Mobley, Reggie.
And the a healthy helping on this concert of the Bach clan. And again, not the so well-known branch of the Bach clan. Heinrich Bach was the great uncle of Johann Sebastian Bach. And Johann Christoph, not to be confused with J.S. Bach's son, Johann Christian, Johann right. Christoph Bach was the eldest of Heinrich Bach's son, who became a musician as well. Here now, music of Heinrich Bach. Heinrich Bach or Johann Christoph Bach with countertenor Reggie Mobley.
Even more confusing, there's another Johann Christoph Bach.
Well, let's keep things as clear as we can for this, this next segment. All right. Hit it, guys.
Gemacht. am Tage seines grimmigen Zorns, grimmigen Zorns, grimmigen Zorns, seines grimmigen Zorns. Ich was ist Glück, was ist Glück, was ist Glück hätte in meinen Haupte und meine Augen Tränen quellen wären und meine Augen Tränen quellen wären, dass ich Tag und Nacht, Tag und Nacht, Tag und Nacht beweinen könnte.
Music of Johann Christoph Bach, son of the great uncle of Johann Sebastian Bach, the lament Ach, dass ich was es genug hätte, sung live in the KLW studios. A little choked up on that, I'm sorry. Reginald Mobley, countertenor. Reginald is a regular soloist with Sir John Elliott Gardner and the Monteverdi Choir, and English Baroque soloist. He recently made his debut with the Academy of Ancient Music, as well as with this Royal Scottish National Orchestra, the Seattle Symphony, and the Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra. Reginald, welcome to you, and thank you so much for sharing that amazing piece of music.
Thank you.
Boy, and this whole concert was in large part your idea, wasn't it, in terms of putting this type of a program together?
I guess.
Collaborative.
Collaborative. Sure. There are a lot of hands in the pot on that one.
Sure, and
I just wrote my name on the outside.
Yeah, well, I quoted from some of your program notes at the beginning. Could you share a little bit more about the way this program came together?
Our first major collaboration together was the music of Isabella Leonarda, our first disc of their Queen of Heaven, and when we decided to do another project, we added more of me and we swapped Latin for German. And because there's so much beautiful music that we kind of got together and decided we should do, and Henry's always finding something new and hidden under things and various pillars and stones and bird cages or something like that. We just started forming this concert around the music of the German Baroque, especially 17th century German Baroque. And it occurred to me that I was just reading something about the 30 Years' War and saw that, oh, well, 18's coming up soon. Why don't we maybe consider doing something that may, you know, do a concept program that kind of centers around that. And as we talked more about it and thought of more things, it really began to hit me how personal this music was to me, coming from being someone who actually does quite a lot of music of, you know, spirituals and music of Afro-American slaves and black composers and music in general, and gospel music and jazz and all those sorts of things. And I've always held this strong belief that there is a strong spiritual tie between the music of this period and the music that our people sang in fields or sang in halls or sang in churches. Happy Black History Month, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the music, it was so important to me because of the fact that these are musicians who lived and worked during a time of extreme duress and tragedy, seeing death. I mean, you lived with death constantly, and you lived with sorrow, you lived with woe. And I can't think of another time period that maybe another group of people lived in such terrible conditions, whether it be because of war or actually because of slavery. And all of that pain found its way into music for the Germans in that period. And the same way, I think, that same pain and sorrow found its way into the songs of slaves and the songs of Black Americans who lived in Jim Crow area, and all before civil rights, and honestly, now. So it just became more and more personal of a project to all of us, I think, and very much so to me. So I think that's a lot of how it came, at least from my side of things.
Countertenor Reginald Mobley performing with Agave Baroque. I should mention that the music you're hearing today was just released on CD. You can go to Agave Baroque for more information about that. But do consider coming to the concerts this weekend. Amazing music of love and loss in the shadow of the 30 Years' War. In that last piece, you also heard Henry Levadinsky performing on organ, which he toted into the KLW studios. Thank you for doing so, Henry.
No worries.
And tell us a little bit about the other composers that are represented on the program. We talked about the Arm of the Bach Tree. Some Samuel Scheidt, some Matthias Veckman that we heard, I think, to open things up. Who are the other composers that are involved?
Well, one of the most interesting composers that we researched for this program was David Pohle, who is a student of the great German composer Heinrich Schütz, who is himself a student of Gabrielli in Venice. And so what you have here is the Venetian polychoral style. This was the height of what we think of as late Renaissance and transitional music at the beginning of the 17th century. Schütz, along with composers like Rosenmüller, were really important in bringing the Italian style into Germany right before and during the 30 Years' War. There was a lot of migration and a lot of travel, whether it was for work or for, unfortunately, less positive circumstances due to some of the hardships of the fighting. Pohle was lucky enough to study with Schütz in Dresden, and then he ended up working in Merseburg and a couple of other smaller communities. And his music is very typical of this central German style of the period. There's a lot of interesting texture. The use of the middle voices, the viola, really is the crucial block in all of this. The harmonies lent by this big band viola sound. Yeah, viola power. We got some serious viola power advocates here. And what you have is the combination of this really rich texture with this beautiful, most probably original text by David Pohle, which speaks of just the longing for the better life to come in the next life, a deep trust in God to bring us through these hard times, a really honest and deep faith, and that's what's being explored in this composition. Mm,
fascinating. I mentioned that you did haul in the organ, and then we're hearing in the background a little bit the mechanism for keeping the organ actually having air go through it. I guess you'd call it the compressor.
That's the Jarvik 7 artificial heart that we imported into this process.
Very nice. But since, you know, radio is not so keen on the visual end of things, tell us the instrument that you actually brought into it, and could we hear a little bit about what it can do?
This is an example of what in modern early music, right? Early music is really a 20th century construct in the idea of looking to recreate something from so long ago with eyes to how it would have been performed back then. There were very few organs that were able to be moved by one person back in the 17th and 18th century. The organ was usually installed in the church or in the chapel or in the palace. In fact, most organs had a component that most people don't think about when you think about the organ, and that is the room in which it's in. The relationship of instrument and acoustic was core to what the organ was all about. So when searching to make an organ portable, both in the 18th century and now, we had to figure out how little we could put in there. So we have one rank of pipes. That's a pipe for every single note that I play from bottom to top. A wind chest, which is the bag of the bagpipe, really, and a source of wind. Back then, you would have had portable instruments where you would have had a family member or a servant standing next to you, pumping up and down with an arm or with a foot controlling the bellows mechanism. This is the part where we've brought it into the 19th and early 20th century by putting a small electric blower, basically a vacuum cleaner engine, into this that powers the rest of the
instrument. Well, I think we've all seen those Renaissance paintings of the tabletop small organs. But this is more, I'd say, maybe a spinet size.
That's the big sister, but you basically have every component in that medieval table organ in this thing. There's a wind supply, there's a wind chest to hold the pressure, and the pipes and the key mechanism which opens the valves and gives you the air.
Give us a quick example of what this thing can do. I mean, we've heard it as an accompanying instrument, but here, let's hear what sounds this is capable of. Should be without one. Just beautiful. Now, we talked a little about the viola power in this particular concert, and for the most part, we're hearing the upper strings and even the lower strings that are familiar to most audiences, perhaps with some different techniques, perhaps with gut strings in some cases of the instruments, but we also are treated in this room to having a theorboist, Kevin Cooper, which must be a very difficult instrument to talk airlines into allowing as a carry-on.
Yeah, it's a huge, long instrument. I can't even buy a seat for it like a cellist can. So I just have a very good case. I check it below and say my prayers.
So can you just describe it for us? Hold it up to the microphone and so people can see it.
So it looks a little bit like a lute in that it has the pear-shaped or teardrop-shaped body. And then it has a neck that is twice as long as a lute or a guitar, so that you can have notes that are twice as low. So it makes sense. Nowadays, you can achieve that by having thicker strings, because we've come up with the technology to wind the strings. But back then, they came up with elongating the strings.
In terms of the size, think of even taller than Peter Dinklage. If you were to stand the thing up.
I have to get out of my seat to tune some of the notes and walk over to the tuners. It's so big. It's
and it has what's known as sympathetic vibrations going on as well. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly. None of the strings are designed to specifically do that, although any instrument, yes, there's a frequency that gets bigger when the notes are sympathetic.
So the additional strings, though, are for added range, then?
That's correct. They're tuned like a scale.
Very nice.
There's 14 of them.
And, of course, it can go higher with the frets you have on the regular part of the
instrument. Yeah, true. And in the middle, there's a section that is quite a bit like a guitar. So if you play guitar, you can get started on theorbo relatively easily.
Nice. Well, we do have time for one more piece of music. I'd love for you to share another piece of music, hopefully with Reginald singing as well. Let's see. Aaron, can you tell us what we're going to hear next?
So Henry mentioned David Pola earlier, who's a not terribly well-known composer, and we were all just really thrilled to find this piece. And it's kind of ended up, it's the lead track on our album, Peace in Our Time, which Vigo Recordings is releasing this weekend. We're going to play a slightly shortened version of it just to fill a few minutes.
Live in the KLW studios, Agave Baroque with Reginald Mobley.
Thank you.
ich habe. Herr, wenn ich nur dich habe, nur dich habe. So frage ich nicht nach Himmel und Erde. So frage ich nicht nach Himmel und Erde, nach Himmel und Erde, nach Himmel und Erde.
In the KALW studios, Agave Baroque with Reginald Mobley performing music of Pola in that performance here in the studios. That work to be performed on Friday at Palo Alto's First Presbyterian Church on Cowper Street, Saturday in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian, and Sunday here in San Francisco at 4 o'clock matinee at Church of the Advent. Thank you guys so much for coming in today. Absolutely amazing performances. And to set all this up for us here in KLW, we're very, very grateful.
Thanks for having
me.
Of course, of course. Again, more information about these concerts are at sfems.org. Concerts, the San Francisco Early Music Society presents Agave Baroque with countertenor Reginald Mobley, Peace in Our Time, Music of Love and Loss in the Shadow of the 30 Years' War. Well, next here on KLW, a bit of a shift of scenery and a shift of venue in terms of where we'll be seeing these next performances. Not only celebrating Bernstein's 100th anniversary with a performance of Trouble in Tahiti, but also performances of Jake Heggie's chamber opera In the Shadow of Venus. Nicole Pamont, the wonderful director of Ensemble Parallel, Opera Parallel, joins me by phone, and the wonderful composer Jake Heggie in studio once again. Jake, I'm so honored that you have taken the time to spend with us today, given the incredible riches that the world is experiencing right now for Jake Heggie works. I mean, productions of Dead Man Walking in Madrid with Joyce DiDonato in the starring role of Sister Helen. That will also be presented later this month as a semi-stage production at the Barbican in London. Dead Man Walking also staged at Minnesota Opera. This production here at SF Jazz, I can see why you're not perhaps by choice in Minnesota this time of year, but why the heck aren't you in Madrid?
I just came back from Madrid, actually. It's good to see you, by the way. Great to be here. I just came back from Madrid, which was amazing, and I am going to Minnesota for the final performance on Saturday and then to Baltimore for a workshop of a new opera.
Fantastic. So, I mean, you also have a residency coming up at Peabody in Baltimore.
Yes,
so that coincides rather well.
Exactly. It's a good time. I have no complaints.
I should say, and also Moby Dick is going to be at the Pittsburgh Opera in March, which was just done last week in Salt Lake City. So time management for you must be both a challenge and a pleasure.
This is a nice problem to have. I do have to try to stay home because I am working on actually three new pieces, including a big opera for next summer for the Marilla Opera Program.
Wow, what's that going to be?
It's called If I Were You. It's a modern day Faust story. And it's specifically for a young artist program, so for the Marilla Singers. And it's their first opera they've ever commissioned in their 60 years. And so Gene Shear and I are working on that right now. Very excited about it.
Very nice. It's always nice to hear about your new works and especially what's coming up before our conversation is over. I hope you can give us a tease of the exciting addition to the San Francisco opera season next year.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's from 2016, it'll be new to us at least.
Well, and it's newly revised. First performance of a piece is kind of a workshop too, because it's all a mystery until the final character shows up, and that's the audience. And until then, everyone's been working on it on their own, which is why Broadway shows are so lucky to have previews in front of live audiences. So the first production in Houston in 16 was where we learned about it. Gene and I have done a lot of rewrites and changes. It's about 15% shorter than it was before.
Yeah.
And there are new arias and duets. It's very exciting. The production that San Francisco gets this fall at the San Francisco Opera of It's a Wonderful Life will be new to all of us. It's very exciting.
Very nice. So watch for that at SF Opera next season. Yeah. This work is something that you've been working with Opera Parallel on, co-mounting with the Bernstein Classic, and this dates from 2005, I believe, this work.
Yes. It's got a libretto by Terrence McNally. It's an original story. We were commissioned to write something for the opening of the new opera house in Denver, the L.A. Calkins Opera House, and it was written for my friend Kristen Clayton, who is a wonderful soprano in San Francisco, with piano. And it's about a woman waiting for a blind date at the Statue of Venus, and about everything that could go wrong goes wrong, and she's very insecure and nervous, and it's classic Terrence McNally situation. And the music is very jazzy and fun, and then it goes into soaring lyricism as well. And there haven't been that many fully staged productions. And a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, I orchestrated it when I was in residency at UT Austin. And so Nicole Paimon asked me about that and decided to pair it with Trouble in Tahiti, great Bernstein work. And Bernstein is a huge influence on my work. So it seemed like a good pairing to me. So I'm excited to see what they've done with it. Brian Stauffenbeel and Nicole Paiement are so brilliant what they do and what they bring to us in San Francisco. And it's at SF Jazz. And it's just going to be a really wonderful experience.
You hear that, Nicole? You're getting quite a plug there. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for taking some time out of your rehearsal. I know you've got limited time to share with us right now. And congratulations on, first of all, the beautiful performances of The Little Prince with music by Rachel Portman last December.
Oh, thank you so much.
And as Jake mentioned, the Paiement-Stauffenbeel juggernaut continues with this presentation. Terrific reviews of your 2013 production here in San Francisco of Trouble in Tahiti. Anything different that we'll see in this production?
Oh, yes, it's quite different. Well, first of all, the idea of combining it with Jake's piece, that, by the way, is a real gem, made us really rethink of how we wanted to. We enjoy at times, we've done that with Kurt Weill and Poulenc, bringing two brilliant composers together and sort of figuring out a way to present in a unique way two works that are shorter and perhaps would not receive as much staging opportunities because of the fact that they are shorter, and bring them in a new light. So we looked at Trouble in Tahiti very much in the light of having also the Statue of Venus by Jake on the program, and bringing what brings them together, because one of the idea was not only to celebrate Bernstein, but to also celebrate the great American voice in music that we have with Jake and Bernstein. And at a time where perhaps it's more difficult to feel great about America, for some of us anyway, we felt that this was really bringing something wonderful about a beautiful American, the beautiful American voice that we have in opera. And that's what we're celebrating in those two works. And by working with them, I was very impressed how Brian has brought small elements, like in Terence's piece, in Jake's piece, in the Terence's libretto, he has this very, very moving moment about when she, the woman who's at the blind date, waiting for her blind date, is talking about her father when she was a child. And then when we are in the Bernstein opera, when the women, the Dinah goes to see her therapist, she talks about her father and seeing her father in the garden and that. So small details, the gymnopédie that we have in the Bernstein, and then there's an illusion, I think musically, maybe not, Jake maybe didn't think of that it was maybe not intentional, but I hear a part of the third gymnopédie of Satie somewhere in there. So there's all these relationships that we've been bringing out, and because the idea behind it is that the woman that is at the blind date at the Statue of Venus, who is Rose in Jake's piece, becomes Dinah Rose, becomes the woman, basically she finds her husband at that blind date, and they marry. And in the second half, we are in Trouble in Tahiti. They now live in the suburb, they have a child, and they're experiencing life in a very different way. And so this whole perspective has definitely changed the way that we're approaching Trouble in Tahiti.
That's fantastic, and so creative in combining the two works. It's wonderful.
And that's really,
they work beautifully together.
And that is really wonderfully typical of opera parallel, to find these parallels between pieces that you might not expect. I never thought of pairing, my piece with the Bernstein, but when I think about it, now that I've really lived with it, it makes total sense. I do have that Bernstein influence in my writing, and also it is the story of a woman looking for hope and love and possibility in her life. And so is the Bernstein, except that they're in a shut down situation, but they're yearning for something bigger and better. Mm. So,
Well, it's you guys are no strangers to working together, so it's wonderful that you're able to collaborate on this. Now, last week I had the pleasure of talking with Sherry Greenewald of the San Francisco Opera Center, who played the role of the old lady in Bernstein's Candide recently with the San Francisco Symphony. And I mentioned that almost everyone has a Lenny story. Now, Jake, you're of a younger generation. You mentioned he's an inspiration. Did you ever have a chance to meet with him?
No? I did meet him a few times, and he... the thing I remember, I met him after a concert. My teacher, Joanna Harris, who was married to Roy Harris, introduced me, and he grabbed my hand and held it so tightly I thought my hand was going to break into 1,000 pieces. He kept holding on to it while he was talking to the rest of the room, and I was trying to get my hand away because it hurt so bad. But it was all his passion and energy and enthusiasm and excitement. I've never met a man that was more on fire with music and ideas and possibility. And I saw him conduct several times and got to meet him a few times.
What about you, Nicole?
No, sadly, I've never met him. You know, I've had the opportunity of seeing him because of, you know, what all the wonderful recordings he's done, and also the, you know, the television program that you can now see. But I was not, you know, being raised in the French culture, I was not so, I heard his music. My parents had recordings, some of his recordings, so I definitely heard his performances and his interpretations of work, but I...
And chances are you've heard some secondhand stories of some people that have worked with him.
Yes. Actually, you know, our past president of Opera Parallel worked as a stage manager to Bernstein in New York, and he has told me some amazing stories about Bernstein.
But I'll tell you, those early musicals of his... On the Town, Wonderful Town, West Side Story, they're iconic pieces that, and they influenced me enormously. Those pieces and Sondheim and Gershwin, they were the biggest influences on me early on. And so to actually have met both Bernstein and Sondheim, I dedicated the score of Moby Dick to Stephen Sondheim. He's been such an influence on me. But Bernstein, especially, I think, in At the Statue of Venus, is a huge influence. And way to pay tribute to him.
Well, speaking of the Bernstein-Sondheim collaboration and West Side Story, that'll be performed, the remastered version of the film will be screened tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday with the San Francisco Symphony performing live accompaniment.
Amazing.
So that should be a lot of fun. But more importantly, we hope that you can, dear audience, come and hear Trouble in Tahiti and
At the Statue of Venus.
At SF Jazz, presented with Opera Parallel. Nicole, I know you've got to get back to rehearsal. We'll say adieu to you, mon cher.
I would like to say one small thing, though, just because I think it's also another wonderful collaboration. The production that you will see is that because it's Jake's piece is staged, you know, it takes place in a museum. We really took that and pushed the boundaries of transforming the SF Jazz into somewhat of a museum atmosphere, in that, first of all, we have a live statue that will at one point come to life. Because we're honoring Bernstein, also we're doing a very short piece as an introduction to the evening, the unanswered question that, you know, was Ives' piece that really influenced Bernstein.
Sure, yeah.
And the statue will come to life and express a little bit of that major theme that Jake spoke about, the searching for love and the unanswered question of what love is, and that. So that's kind of something that I wanted to bring up. But also, we have collaborated with a collage artist, Sherry Parker, who actually has a opening tomorrow, actually, in Oakland, in one of the galleries there. She's a beautiful miniature collage artist, and she's collaborated with us in creating art that first will be decomposed and floating in the space in the hall, and as the audience is coming in and we're getting ready to start, these little pieces will come together and combine and create her collage art into frames that make us sort of feel like we're entering a gallery. So it's another collaboration of having a visual artist and also a dancer. And the dancer is choreographed by Amy Zivert, with whom we collaborated many times now, a beautiful choreographer.
Fantastic.
So I'm really proud about all of these collaboration that's going on right now.
We're looking forward to the performances, and yes. I know you're looking forward to performing Jake's work. Let's talk again soon for the next wonderful collaboration. Okay, Nicole.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Jake, we just have time for a brief excerpt from your work. We're going to hear the track, what's the one? The Slacks Were a Mistake. Set that up for us.
Oh, well, this is right when Rose, the character at the Statue of Venus, arrives at at the statue and realizes she's decided to wear black slacks, and she just is horrified that of all the things she could have worn, pants. Okay.
Music of Jake Eggy. Thanks for coming in, Jake. More soon, I hope.
The slates were a mistake. Too late now. Brazen it out. Look him in the eye. Make him say what you want him to say. It's not about how you're dressed, it's about who you are. And who I am right now is a woman who wishes she wasn't wearing slacks. Weren't wearing slacks, wasn't wearing slacks. Weren't, wasn't, whatever. God, I hate that expression.
Music of Jake Heggy to be heard at SF Jazz in combination with Opera Parallel. Jake Heggy's At the Statue of Venus along with Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. sfjazz.org for more information. Well, now for something completely different and brief. Morris Bobrow is a San Francisco treasurer who's been compared to his musical review style of a combination of Nichols and May crossed with the Carol Burnett Show. He's been writing and producing his reviews for over 40 years with such titles as Foodies, The Musical, Shopping, The Musical, Party of Two, The Mating Musical, Are We Almost There, and Party of One. Additional shows in collaboration, New Wrinkles, Quirks, and what? Give Up Showbiz? Maury has been doing this stuff for some 40 years. Such a pleasure to welcome him to our airwaves to talk about Megabytes, the musical, about the frustrations, anxieties, annoyances, and occasional joys we encounter as we all struggle to cope with the challenges created by technology. Maury, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, obviously, this technology is rife with all kinds of ways to parody and to both complain and celebrate.
That's right. Actually, one of our numbers is if you have a tech problem, call an 8-year-old. That's where you'll get the best advice.
That's what we're going to go out with for music. Ask an 8-year-old.
Good.
But also, there's some catchphrases that are thrown throughout the musical that I think people will be familiar with. For instance, let's go with butt call.
Yes. Butt calls. I do them all the time, and people think I'm calling them, but I'm not calling them. And I know that's very frustrating to the person getting the calls. But we have a number about a fellow who's been fired recently because he tries to make a living teaching cursive, which nobody uses anymore.
You know, it's funny you said that. I don't even, you know, I barely write a signature anymore, let alone.
Well, we say probably a signature is going to amount to an X pretty soon.
These performances are at the Shelton Theater on Sutter Street and Union Square. So tell me a little bit about the cast you've assembled for these.
Well, we have a great cast. The people in the show are Kim Larson, Deborah Russo, David Goodwin, and Lisa McHenry. And we have a wonderful pianist named Ben Keim. And together they've been just wowing the audiences. They've worked together. These folks have worked together for many years. And so there's a great chemistry there. So it's a lot of fun. You can tell they're having a lot of fun.
You also do work on the corporate side of things, doing original reviews for, corporations ranging from Apple and Price Waterhouse. How do you get inside the corporations? You're obviously going to mine these places for their humor without making sure you don't push the wrong buttons.
Exactly. That's the challenge. Yeah, a lot of times people after these shows they come up and they say, "Gee, you know, we thought you actually worked for the company," and which is a great compliment because it means I've touched them, I've communicated with them, and I've understood the issues they're going through. And it's whether they're trying to sell a new product or whether they're dealing with a certain political issues within the company or whatever it is, we put it into musical comedy, and the message is far more effective that way than somebody getting up and giving a speech, for instance.
Well, we're going to look forward to Megabytes the Musical. It's a world premiere comedy review written and directed by Maury Bobrow at the Shelton Theater. And as you mentioned, Ask an 8-Year-Old is probably the good way to go out with this. Maury, let's have you back again when you can spend some more time with us.
Thank you.
If you got a tech problem that you can't solve, ask an 8-year-old. He'll show you how easy it is to resolve. Ask an 8-year-old. The kid will quickly grasp the facts and cut to the problem's essence. This skill set seems to be inherent in prepubescence. He's like a teacher who will never scold, so ask an 8-year-old. You don't have to pay the kid, that would just seem tacky. You might offer advice that he could use, like giving the cure for acne. If you want the smartest tech person in the room, ask an 8-year-old. He must have started learning in the womb. Ask an 8-year-old. But if the gobbledygook you see makes no reason or rhyme, be sure to call before 7 p.m., 'cause that's the kid's bedtime.
Ask an 8-year-old. Music of Maury Bobrow is part of Megabytes the Musical. Go to megabytesthemusical.com for more information about those performances, which runs through March 3rd at the Shelton Theater in the Union Square area. megabytesthemusical.com. A very good afternoon to you, David LaTalib, now joined by our regular commentator, Peter Robinson, who's patiently been sitting by, and will talk, give us a little tease of a movie review as well as a tease of some other Oscar prospects. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And my movie for the week is literally The Post. That's Steven Spielberg's The Post. And what I feel about this, although it deals with the question of the freedom of the press in 1971, I think 35 years later, we're still looking at that critical issue as the President of the United States challenges different journalistic institutions, mostly through his Twitter feed, and truth seems to become a looser term than ever before. And of course, truth is the issue in The Post, and we're looking at the time when the publication of the Pentagon Papers was put under embargo. These first appeared in the New York Times, only to be stopped, and then the story got taken up by the Washington Post. So this is very much a newspaper story. You've got Tom Hanks playing the editor, Ben Bradley, and of course Meryl Streep is back there as Kay Graham. And I think the issues they fight, the issues they discuss, are every bit as alive today as we grapple as journalists over this whole question of freedom of the press. Daniel Ellsberg is played by Matthew Rhys, and he literally in real life carried thousands of pages on the history of Vietnam into the photocopying rooms. And when we use the word today fake news, I think what he was trying to reveal was fake history. Because this is a story about the lies, and above all, the lies that cost the lives of many, many Americans and, of course, Vietnamese in the ensuing war. McNamara knew we couldn't win as early as 1965. 6 years later, with thousands of deaths on their hands, the truth was revealed. And that, of course, is the story behind The Post. Highly recommended, and will certainly, for those who remember the period, keep you gripped. And for those who don't know the period, I think they will be strangely informed.
With Hollywood's power couple, so to speak, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, amazing performances of The Post. And I think that's a nice segue to perhaps lead to some future Oscar picks, maybe not for this year, but who are you banking on, Peter?
Well, I hate to say it in a British accent, but here we go. I think The Darkest Hour, mainly because of the individual performance where the actual makeup artist has turned Gary Oldman into a real live Churchill. So I hope he gets an award, but if he doesn't, I hope the makeup man gets the award.
Indeed, and that's a portrait of Churchill, warts and all, that's for sure.
Absolutely. An interesting runner-up is Christopher Nolan with his movie about Dunkirk, and these two are good companion pieces. It's the first time that Christopher Nolan has been suggested as a director, and of course it is for the screenplay and I think the photography. And then a couple of sleepers back there. I have to take my mind back to earlier this year when a movie called Get Out was playing. It's sometimes with the Oscars, it's usually from September onwards that we remember the films. I saw this one earlier in the year. And I think in terms of satire, in terms of racism, in terms of understanding the confusion about liberal attitudes, I think Get Out with Daniel Kaluuya may well deserve an award. And for Daniel Day-Lewis, he's told us he's leaving. We'll see if that's true. The Phantom Thread, I found a very slow film, but there's no doubt that his acting certainly merited a worthy award. And Timothy Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name is also in there. So we've got an interesting, how can I put it, an interesting lineup this year. And back in the hot seat, Jimmy Kimmel will be presenting. And let's hope at the very end he gets the winners correct. So we don't have another repeat of La La Land and Moonlight interchangeable as possible winners. So I think we've got an interesting selection, and I should mention Sally Hawkins, who really did turn in a magnificent performance for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Stay watching. I'll be there. Let's see who's right, but I think we've got an interesting lineup this year.
Thank you very much, Peter, and I'm sure you'll be reporting back to us. Speaking of an interesting lineup here in San Francisco, just such a jam-packed weekend of events going on. Just four more opportunities for you to catch the sumptuous first offering of the current San Francisco ballet season. Tomorrow and Saturday at 8, with matinees on Saturday and Sunday as well, Tchaikovsky's gorgeous music to Sleeping Beauty, which you're hearing in the background, the famous waltz music, conducted by Martin West, with Helgi Thomason's choreography and principal dancers Sasha DeSola and Anna Sophia Scheller sharing the dream role of Aurora. Information at sfballet.org. The Berkeley Symphony this season is offering concerts both in its usual venue tonight at Zellerbach Hall and now adding a performance here in San Francisco on Friday at the San Francisco Conservatory. With Joanna Carnero out once again on maternity leave, the orchestra will be conducted by Kaitaro Harada. On the program, Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, Fauré's Cantique de Jean Racine, and Gordon Getty's Joanne and the Bells, with featured soloists Lisa Dallan and Lester Lynch, baritone. A full evening of weekend of concerts, including our own Sarah Cahill performing with the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble tonight at the and tomorrow and tonight and Saturday at the Berkeley Piano Club on Haste Street, and then on Monday at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. The program, Visions de l'Amen, Oliver Messiaen's towering work for two pianos, colorful, mystical, glorious. Eric Zivian from the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble is joined by Sarah Cahill in these performances. Information at leftcoastensemble.org. That and more happening here in the Bay Area. We are so lucky to have such a rich performance opportunities here. And as I mentioned, live performance of the San Francisco Symphony accompanying the classic, now remastered, 1961 film West Side Story. That'll be conducted by David Newman. 10 Academy Award winning, directed by Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins, featuring Robbins' choreography and the book by Stephen Sondheim. Music, of course, by Stephen Sondheim. That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulipe. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show.